Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. More than a decade ago, Wyoming Republicans backed a change to the state constitution, which gave people the right to make their own health care decisions. It was meant to signal disapproval of the Affordable Care Act.
My fellow senators, I think it's about choice, about whether you're free to choose it, whether you're free not to choose it.
That amendment was just used to strike down two near total abortion bans in the state. And climate change, energy transition, affording everyday life, all big topics on our minds. How that all might be affected in Wyoming with Donald Trump as our next president.
People really are asking for change. Whether he can deliver, and he and his administration, is a whole other question.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
This is Classical Wyoming, with great music 24 hours every day. If you would like to see the playlist, go to classicalwyoming.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Recently, a state judge struck down two abortion bans in Wyoming. The decision hinged almost entirely on a constitutional right Republicans fought for in the wake of the passage of the Federal Affordable Care Act. It allows residents to make their own healthcare decisions. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach explains how conservatives ended up fighting against a measure they backed.
On a stormy winter evening, the Teton County District Judge sent out an email. There was a new ruling in Wyoming's ongoing legal battle over abortion rights. Jovanina Anthony is a women's health provider based in Jackson.
I think it might be time to have a glass of wine for sure.
That's because Anthony has been fighting this battle for the last few years. She was one of several advocates who sued the state after it passed two near-total abortion laws, which never fully went into effect because of the litigation.
So I honestly now just heard about this, 5 minutes ago? I just feel this wave of relief washing over me as I think about the women of this state and other states who are continuing to fight for their rights.
She's been waiting 11 months for this decision, but the legal ruling has roots that date back to 13 years ago.
Senate will come to order.
Back in 2011, Wyoming lawmakers gathered on the Senate floor to talk about changing the state's constitution. It was the second reading of the proposed amendment.
There's four paragraphs. First one is, each competent adult shall have the right to make his or own her health care decisions.
Senator Drew Perkins led the charge. The amendment was in response to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Republicans were fuming. They were worried that people would be forced into the federal health care system.
And that's what this is about, my fellow senators. I think it's about choice, about whether you're going to free to choose it, whether you're free not to choose it.
The next year, over 75% of Wyoming voters ultimately approved the amendment, giving the right to make health care decisions. The same happened in a handful of other conservative states, such as Arizona and Oklahoma. That's according to Mary Ziegler, a historian and law professor at the University of California.
It was just sort of like a messaging bill, right, where Republicans were using it to signal disapproval, you know, to message to voters what they thought they were losing with the Affordable Care Act.
But Ziegler says that health care access amendment has come back to bite Republicans, who now want to ban abortion. In the ruling, the district court judge wrote, "The abortion bans violate the right to make health care decisions for an entire class of people, pregnant women." Ziegler says in the flurry of abortion cases we've seen since Roe v. Wade was overturned, this is a new tactic. Other states are using different parts of the Constitution.
Addressing due process or equal protection or the right to life or bodily integrity, like things that are less specifically healthcare focused.
But with Wyoming's constitutional amendment in her back pocket, the Teton County judge argued that abortion is protected since it counts as health care, according to dictionary definitions and medical associations. The state of Wyoming and anti-abortion groups, though, disagree.
Abortion is not health care.
Marty Halverson runs the group Wyoming Right to Life. Back on that stormy night, she had been out shoveling snow and was still processing the news.
It destroys the two-patient paradigm and allows one patient to be killed and somehow benefiting the other patient.
Governor Mark Gordon has already directed his legal team to appeal the ruling, saying he's committed to defending the sanctity of life.
Wyoming Right to Life is looking forward to the appeal to the Wyoming Supreme Court.
Even so, Wyoming's legislative session is coming up in January, and both political sides are already planning to introduce laws to further back their belief. Democrats have said they'll introduce a bill enshrining the right to abortion, and a couple of Republicans are saying they want to place more guardrails on doctors prescribing abortion pills. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson.
President-elect Donald Trump campaigned on rolling back many of the climate-oriented energy transition policies of President Biden. That's led many of his supporters in the fossil fuel industry to celebrate, and many environmentalists to panic. Yet, amid these polarized reactions, is a lot of uncertainty, especially in an energy-rich state like Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan recently talked to college students about what's on their minds as Trump gets ready to take office. She posed their questions to two professors from the University of Wyoming, Rob Godbee, who researches energy and public policy, and Matt Burgess, who focuses on the political polarization and macroeconomics of climate change. We hear from Burgess first about the current lay of energy policy in America.
The last three presidential terms, including the Biden administration, Trump's first term, and Obama's second term, have been very good for renewables and very good for oil and gas and not very good for coal. And I expect that that's broadly going to continue, largely because many of the important drivers of these trends exist outside of the presidency. So they're at the state and local level, they're in the marketplace. And also those trends are popular. So Americans broadly like all of the above. They want something done on climate change by about 2 or 3 to 1, but there's strong support for oil and gas. There's not strong support at all for phasing out fossil fuels.
Yeah, it kind of adds to that. Renewable energy, natural gas make generating electricity from coal just uneconomic. And so it's become kind of the last choice among the primary ones in electricity generation, and that's going to continue. I mean, if we look at Wyoming, Wyoming has been in a decline in coal production for over the last decade. So as much as people get excited about Donald Trump, if they're in the fossil fuel sector, they might get worried if they're in the climate change sector. I think there are reasons for both of those reactions. But the bottom line is we just don't know until we have some more concrete policy proposals.
So let's take a look at the finer details of what we might see. I was actually recently at Western Wyoming Community College in Rock Springs. I actually recorded some student questions. Here's the first one.
My name is Hagen DeWitt. With the new presidential change, what kind of changes are we going to be looking at with oil drilling and fracking?
So what kind of changes could we see with fracking oil production? Probably less restriction on federal lands for production of oil and natural gas. What's going to be the fly in the ointment is what happens with international prices, particularly for oil. That's really going to be the determinant.
It seems pretty certain that the Trump administration will undo the pause on LNG export terminals, which if global conditions for natural gas continue to be favorable, could be good for the natural gas industry. And then second thing to watch is permitting reform, and that has implications for both oil and gas and for renewables.
So Wyoming's Governor Mark Gordon has said himself, climate change is something we need to address. His strategy has been in all of the above energy policy. meaning we reduce our climate warming emissions by using renewables, but also find cleaner ways to produce traditional energy, like using carbon capture on coal-fired power plants. Do we think Wyoming will still have an appetite for this all of the above strategy under Trump's presidency?
I would say the American public definitely will, and the market definitely will. Nationally, the all of the above approach is very popular. Most people do think climate change is real and want something done about it. Most people do not want to get rid of their fossil fuels. Most people like cheap energy, and most people like renewables. And we're in a state that has lots of fossil resources, lots of wind resources, great geology for carbon capture. Nuclear is another really interesting one to watch.
Wyoming bucks the trend, no pun intended, across a lot of different things. So on renewables, they're far less popular here. While the governor does direct energy policy, we have a new legislature. Certainly there's a lot of energy there, again, no pun intended, around coal, if they can kind of sum it up. But Governor Gordon's plan was really embracing new technologies. There were a lot of energy incentives under the Biden administration for new energy technologies. You know, again, with this new administration, there's a lot of uncertainty around how things might get undone. And then the question is always unintended consequences.
Quick note I'll add that I think is interesting is that I believe that all of President-elect Trump's proposed cabinet appointments related to environment and energy are people who are on the record with all of the above type views.
Rob, you brought up the Freedom Caucus, and they now have the majority in the House of Wyoming's legislature. Some of those members have hinted at climate change denialism, supporting more pro-coal policy, possibly rolling back some carbon capture efforts. Do you think that at least represents a little bit of a vibe shift?
So emphasizing coal is really difficult. We ship out more than 90% of the coal that we produce. And so really what determines what happens to coal is what people decide in other states. And mainly that's being determined by the market. If you were to roll back carbon capture, interestingly, that might be something that would actually reduce the use of coal in the state. You know, carbon capture in part is being considered because it's being forced on the utilities in this state. So it's funny how these maybe ideologically driven policies might have unintended consequences in the other direction.
An example underscoring that point is Exxon CEO was just in the news recently urging the new Trump administration to not roll back too many of President Biden's climate and energy policies for exactly this reason, that certainty is really important to the long-term investments.
So Bill Gates' nuclear power plant is slated to open in the Kemmer area by 2030. And the hope is for a lot of jobs in Southwest Wyoming. In fact, the Western Wyoming Community College is even creating a nuclear associate's degree. Here's student Hunter Daly.
Is that going to be more on a wide scale across the state of Wyoming? Is this election going to speed up that process?
Nuclear power is widely seen as a major source of clean energy in the long term, but it's unlike most industries, at least in part because of the regulations, it's gotten more expensive to build over time, whereas usually industries get cheaper to build over time. And so the growth is really stalled out in nuclear. And so we'll have to see what happens in terms of the technology now that nuclear is having this bipartisan resurgence. So I would say I wouldn't expect much change, say, in the next 5 years, just given the pace of how these projects go. But in the next 10 and 20 years, who knows?
Kemmer is a laboratory for the country. This is a brand new technology. But under the Biden administration, the Department of Energy asked TerraPower to put together a proposal for where they might build four or five other plants like this. So where are those locations? Likely up in the Powder River Basin, where the transmission infrastructure already exists, possibly in the Dakotas and in Utah.
So let's dive a little deeper on Wyoming's economy. Here's student Errol Asper.
Wyoming, I know, economy is based a lot on energy. Is there reason for an average Wyomingite to be optimistic about the future of Wyoming's like agencies, like schools and different things like that based on the outcome of the election?
So that's really the big question, right? We know that natural gas has been in a decline for the last decade. Coal has been on a decline for more than a decade. those trends are probably not going to change. The most recent consensus estimate that we've made for the state is that we may have peaked in oil production. So long-term, Wyoming's dependence on fossil fuels is a risk. That means that short of finding other revenue sources, our public services are at risk unless we raise taxes. And that brings us to our new legislature. And the number one rally cry from the Freedom Caucus is actually to reduce taxes. So it's one thing to be in opposition. It's another thing to be in power.
I'm curious what you think about how actual Wyomingites might react to policy changes, especially the folks who are trying to make the energy transition as smooth as possible. I'm thinking like city planners, people building new housing projects for anticipated growth. I think this student question gets at that point.
My name is Gabby. I was wondering how the net clear program going to impact our town. Do we have enough room for everybody to live in this town?
So basically, I mean, do we see infrastructure and town revitalization plans continue, even if there is some policy shift away from some of these newer energy projects?
Given the scale of our towns, which are very small, large projects can be really disruptive. And the real question is, how long might that development be there, right? If you build a water system for a town of a certain size and the activity goes on for a decade and then they leave, you've overbuilt. So it's going to be one of the things the new folks in the legislature are going to have to deal with. And on the other side, we do actually have a housing shortage.
This might come up immediately with property tax reform, which for counties that are not getting a lot of mineral royalties can make up a pretty substantial fraction of their budgets.
If you cut property taxes, where does the money come from to backfill those budgets?
Okay. A lot of students asked something along the lines of what Naya Bohe asked.
I was just wondering if like our way of life will ever be able to live. Like, will we just never be able to afford anything?
By almost every measure, the country and the world keeps getting better. Now, certainly there are some wrinkles to that, and housing affordability for young people is one of those wrinkles.
In fact, since the election and actually leading up to the election, we started seeing interest rates rising on mortgages, mainly in part because of the resurgence in support for Trump and the likelihood that he might win. Among economists, it's understood that Trump's policies are probably much more inflationary. He has proposed much more in the way of tax cuts, which will mean more borrowing, which means the government will drive up interest rates just because they have to satisfy their own deficits by borrowing to cover them. He has a pretty major tariff policy, which is likely to drive up inflation, and that drives up interest rates.
Well, you guys, those were all the questions I had. Any other lingering forecasts, thoughts?
Broadly speaking, people are very concerned about trends that have gone on that traditional mainstream economic policy has not really addressed. Things like income inequality, people being left behind. It's a really interesting political and economic time. Certainly, the election of Donald Trump is kind of a symptom of that. People really are asking for change. Whether he can deliver, and he and his administration, is a whole other question.
Well, Rob, Matt, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, it was fun, Caitlin. Thanks.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan speaking with UW professors Rob Godby and Matt Burgess about what the energy transition might look like under a Trump presidency. State of news in Wyoming and how we at Wyoming Public Radio are trying to address it. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Did you know that all 6 episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Wyoming's news ecosystem is changing. Sure, we still have a newspaper in every county, but some of those are run by people about to retire. Many of our legacy papers are getting consolidated by corporations, and we no longer have a statewide paper that prints daily. That's why the newly formed Wyoming Local News Fund conducted a survey of how Wyomingites feel about their news. Founder and director Melissa Cassett has worked as a journalist and editor at publications across the West, and is also the rural media manager for the Solution Journalism Network. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with her.
We're very excited about the survey. It was the first survey that's ever been done on the media ecosystem in Wyoming. Big takeaways, at least as I think about them. Wyoming doesn't have news deserts the way that other states have, which is really good news. We still have a lot of local media. But I say that with some caveats. We have some areas that are drying, heavily drying. And we know that. Journalists know that. Newsrooms know that. And residents know that. They've seen their media change a lot. They've seen their paper shrink. They've seen much less local news available to them. So we're at a point in our history where we have an opportunity to do something about that before we become a state that has real media deserts, meaning that we have full counties that don't have any local news for our residents.
When you started to look at what the respondents were saying, what did you see in terms of the way in which they prefer to get their news?
Yeah, it's so interesting. So many people talked about really preferring their news digitally. I think we think so much about digital news as sort of a young person's game, like the youths want their news online, or they want it on the TikTok, or they want it on Snapchat, or, you know, on these social media platforms. And in our interviews and in our focus groups, we heard so much, and it came up in our survey as well. People across all demographics are really preferring to get their news online in some capacity, and helping our news providers move into that space more is something that really stood out to me.
And what did you find in the survey in terms of the trust that Wyomingites have in the news that they are receiving?
There's some really interesting feedback I'd love to share. One of the questions was along the lines of, do you think your local journalists are in touch with the community? And an overwhelming percentage of people responded, yes, I think local journalists are in touch with the community. Like 75% said that. And that's across all demographics, which I think is an indication of trust. Generally speaking, communities trust local news outlets more than they trust national ones. We know trust is higher in local places for local news than it is for national news. And that is generally reflected in this study as well.
And this kind of gets at the issue that the survey raises about the idea of confirmation bias and just a perception that certain media organizations are biased or are liberal or are conservative.
Yeah, a really good question. I mean, our survey and our study was not intended to look at any sort of political biases in any news organization across the state. But we couldn't pull that out entirely of this study because we are a polarized state. And it came up in our interviews and it came up in our focus groups. People talked about their perceptions of different media outlets. So there are sections of the study that do talk about that.
Although the survey did kind of look specifically at Cowboy State Daily, which I thought was interesting, and mainly because a lot of respondents, it seems like, brought that one up, and because it is growing so quickly.
I think our thought with pulling out Cowboy State Daily specifically is because it has grown so much, it's caught the eye of so many people. You know, they had some criticisms, for sure. We shared some of the criticisms.
And Cowboy State Daily, they are filling a gap that our state has had. You know, we don't have another provider. I mean, noticeably, our residents have noticed the Casper Star Tribune used to have a very big presence in our state. That newsroom has shrunk so significantly. They can't do the coverage that they used to be able to do of this state. We didn't have daily coverage of our state statewide. And Cowboy State Daily is doing daily coverage, digital daily coverage, in a way that nobody else is doing. That's not to say that they have replaced our local papers. We need all the media that we have. We need all the media that we have. But they're doing something that no other outlet is doing. And I think that has caught the eye of our residents in a very significant way.
In the survey, in the respondents, what were they sort of wanting to see in terms of, if you can pull back the curtain on how these news organizations are doing their business, what is it that they would like to find out more about?
What we learned is there is a lot of confusion about how news organizations are set up. There's so many different models of how to set up a news business. And what we heard from readers, listeners, viewers is they don't understand where the money goes, how the money is collected, the difference between the business side of a news organization, the editorial side, where those two connect, who makes the decisions. And I think there's a real opportunity for the news industry to start to pull back that curtain a little bit and let the reader, viewer, listener in on, this is how we're set up. This is who makes editorial decisions. This is how our business works. It seems like there is this connection between transparency and trust in how the business model is set up. And, you know, what we can say is, you know, it's different for every organization. And I think where there's this really great opportunity for news organizations to start to build this trust and conversation with their community is to let them in a little bit and show a little bit about how it works for them.
One of the questions is, are people willing to pay for the news? What did you see in terms of people's responses to that? Are they willing to pay for their news?
No. They don't want to. Some do. You know, it's hard to say. Generally, what we know from this survey and from national surveys is people have less and less of an interest in paying for news. And the thing residents can do now is support the local news they have now. We have great resources in Wyoming now. We're on the cusp in a lot of areas. We are drying, and we've been drying. I mean, we can see in a lot of areas we are one step away from losing some really vital resources. And the best thing that you can do is support those resources while we have them, while we're looking to build what we need. So subscribe to your local papers, listen to your radio stations, support your radio stations, watch your TV stations, support what we have now as we're looking to bolster the system.
We've been talking to Melissa Cassett, who's the director of the new organization, Wyoming Local News Funds. Thank you so much, Melissa, for taking some time to sit down with me.
Thank you for having me.
Like we just heard, the state's news ecosystem is changing, and we as a statewide news outlet are very aware of that. We've actually been working to try to get a better understanding of what Wyomingites want and need from us. So this past month, Wyoming Public Radio reporters visited community colleges around the state to engage with students. More specifically, to try to get a better understanding of what young adults in Wyoming think of journalism and what journalists could be doing better. With me today to talk through this initiative is Wyoming Public Radio's digital producer and engagement coordinator, Ivy Engel.
Hey, Camila.
All right. So real quickly, before we get into the fun stuff, Ivy, can you explain why we decided to go out and engage with community colleges?
Yeah. So about a year ago, we got involved with a program called America Amplified. And some of our listeners might remember that I interviewed the managing editor of America Amplified back in February. The whole point of it is for us as newsrooms to engage with the communities that we cover. So instead of just reporting on what we think is interesting, we're reaching out to our listeners and readers to hear what you all might think we should or need to be reporting on.
Right. So we as a newsroom came together and discussed who our audience is, and within that, who are we lacking? So For example, we know we have a large listener base that is 60 and over. And so as a statewide news service, we felt we were lacking the youth, the people who grow up in Wyoming and actually tend to end up leaving. So we thought it would be good to try to engage with that group, get a better understanding of how and where they consume news and what they think might be missing in coverage about their lives.
Exactly. It's something that we're missing, a huge demographic that we want to make sure we can reach.
So the way that we tried to engage with that group, we went to 3 community colleges in the state in the month of November, Western Wyoming Community College in Rock Springs, Central Wyoming College in Riverton, and Casper College in Mount Casper.
Right. And at each one, a group of reporters set up tables in a common area, like outside of the cafeteria or a coffee shop or something like that. And each group had 3 large pieces of paper with a question written on them. And they asked passersby to add their answers to the paper.
So the questions were, what do journalists often get wrong about you or your life? And what do they get right? How do you decide if a news outlet is trustworthy? And what issues or concerns from your own life don't get covered enough by the news?
And don't forget, Camila, that we also had free snacks, mostly donuts, that helped to entice people to come talk to us, and hence the name we picked for these events, Donuts and Discussion.
Yeah, that turned out to be really helpful in getting people to come talk to us. Also, with that in mind, we didn't ask to record these conversations to allow for a more free exchange. So let's start with our visit to Casper College. We both went to that one, as well as Northeast reporter Jordan Uplinger. Right after the event, he explained his favorite interaction of the day.
Probably the last guy who just came by, and it's because he started that with, I'm the worst person to ask about news. And he had so much to give. That probably shows, like, a lot of people have really good opinions about how we can do the news. They just don't interact with it enough to tell us that yet.
Yeah, I noticed that too. After just a question or two, it turned out they had a lot to say. Also, a lot of people are concerned about bias in their news, which is an incredibly understandable concern. And another thing that we learned was that a lot of people get their news from social media or word of mouth from friends and family, which was interesting to me.
Yeah, and I think our Northwest reporter, Olivia Wheats, who went to Riverton, had a similar experience. People said they don't seek out news, so they don't feel like they have that much to say.
When I asked teens, like, hey, how are you getting your news? A lot of them said social media, Instagram, etc. But when I was talking to teens further, they're on these platforms already, and they're kind of getting served news. It's not like they're, like, seeking out news on these sites, they're just sort of already there.
Social media was actually a common theme we heard between colleges, and a lot of the people that we talked to, they got their news there, and here's Jordan on that.
As far as news that they are learning from, news that they might, or opinions they might agree with, influencers who lean towards their ideological bend, it seems here in Casper, that's firmly on a younger right-wing social media-based news intake.
But not everyone didn't engage with the news. We actually met a lot of people who did and shared with us what they think we should be covering more of. Here's our senior podcast reporter, Melody Edwards, who was in Rock Springs.
Well, one of the first answers that we got was about how Gen Z, they aren't as likely to be able to afford a house or to get Social Security when they retire. So I was kind of surprised that even in Sweetwater County, young people are really worrying about their future in that way.
And here's Hannah Merzbach, our Mountain West News Bureau reporter, who was in Riverton.
I heard a couple people talking about they want more coverage of the political middle. In Wyoming, we have such like extremes with the Freedom Caucus and, you know, the blue bubble over here in Jackson. You know, most people often fall in that middle. We shouldn't make it seem in our coverage like people are on either extreme.
Another theme that came up for the folks in Riverton was also heard by Melody in Rock Springs.
I was not as surprised to get a lot of answers about how concerned they were about the mental health crisis in their community and in their generation and the need in general for more coverage about addiction.
Something that came up a lot for us in Casper was healthcare. We're a big state, and even though the population is small, it runs the gamut in terms of healthcare access, coverage, and just plain understanding of some things. And in response to how people determined if a news outlet is trustworthy, a lot of people look for multiple sources or views in a story.
Yeah, Ivy, I'm glad you brought that point up. By far the most common theme of what journalism gets wrong was bias. And we would ask them, how can we fix that? And at least I didn't get a clear answer. But I do think Olivia got an interesting one. She was in Riverton and a film student came to talk about bias.
And he said, look, by going online, you're picking and choosing which news sites you want to go to. And what he does is that he tries to go to news aggregation sites that give you news from multiple different sources. And he also says he likes to get information from books.
And overall, I really enjoyed our trip to Casper. And for the most part, people were willing to stop and chat, even if they didn't actively seek out news or trust it completely. But a common thread that we did hear a lot was that people appreciated us just making the effort to come out and listen to them, and which I think wasn't just in Casper, really. I think our tribal affairs and rural reporter, Hannah Haberman, summarized it nicely. She was in Riverton.
Students are busy. There were for sure some people who weren't super interested in chatting or were running to their next thing. But overall, it was a really good reminder that just being out in communities and talking to people can be such a good learning experience.
The donuts sure helped entice people. So what are we going to do with all of this? The plan is for us as a newsroom to take people's feedback to heart as we continue to report. So thank you to everyone who has shared their thoughts with us. And I do want to say this is not the end of us coming to communities in the state and asking what you want from us as your statewide public radio station. So we'll keep you updated as we get more of that planned out. And I do want to say before we start going out into the communities again, if you ever want to ask us a question or tell us what you think we should be covering, you can always email us at wyomingpublicradio@gmail.com. So with that, thanks for joining me today, Ivy.
Thanks, Camila. I'm excited for more of these engagement projects down the road.
This past fall, the remains of an Eastern Shoshone boy were returned to the Wind River Reservation. We'll hear from someone who helped bring him home. This is Open Spaces.
Part of why I love Wyoming Public Radio is because it is probably the last remaining really truly valid radio format here in the U.S. because it still provides really valid content that you can't get anywhere else.
I love Wyoming Public Radio. It's just important.
Help celebrate I Love Wyoming Public Radio Week by clicking the I Love Wyoming Public Radio icon at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can access listener testimonials and find out how to record your own. Just look for I Love Wyoming Public Radio at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more 4 times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kodalska. This fall, the remains of an Eastern Shoshone boy were brought back to the Wind River Reservation from the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. William Nakoke arrived at the boarding school in 1881 when he was 8 and died there 11 years later from tuberculosis. He was one of many Native children taken from their homes and separated from their culture during the assimilation era. John St. Clair is the former chairman of the Eastern Shoshone Business Council. Nakoke would have been his uncle. St. Clair traveled to Carlisle with other members of the tribe to help bring his relative home. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman sat down with St. Clair at his kitchen table to hear about that process.
I think it was the second day that we were there. The casket was opened and the remains were taken out. The tribal members actually witnessed the whole process until it took about 5 hours. And because of the time that had passed and the condition of the soil, which is a moist area, Pennsylvania, that it had to be very careful in taking the remains out. The spiritual leader, Arlen Shoyo, was with us, and as the process went forward, he offered cedaring and prayers and tobacco along the way during the whole process of disinterment. He was wrapped in a Muslim cloth and placed in a cedar box that the army had made. And there was also a buffalo hide and penitent blanket that was placed in the box. He was then journeyed home on the 28th of September.
At the funeral and feast for William before he was buried at the cemetery, how are people feeling and what emotions came up for you?
What I've observed and felt was from the people was a feeling of relief because he had been brought home and buried in the area where he was raised. And I think one person said, now he can rest.
A few weeks ago, President Biden formally apologized for the government's role in boarding schools, calling it a sin on our souls. For you, what was on your mind when you heard that apology?
That's a good first step in the right direction. The boarding schools was just one aspect of assimilation, and there's these other areas of assimilation, the General Lawton Act, the churches, the court system, and even going back further, physical extermination, the wars, and decimation of the buffalo, those things, there should be some apology for that too, you know, because that had a major effect on the existence of tribes. So, you know, at the turn of the century, there was less than 1 million Native Americans in this country. And when the Europeans came, there's estimated to be about 10 million. And so we were almost wiped out completely. We begin to recover, not because of anything that the white man has done, it's because of our resilience. When we were prohibited from, say, having the Sundance and doing our religious things, that didn't stop completely. It just kind of went underground. And so those things continued. And I think that's the resiliency of tribal members to not only preserve their culture, but to preserve their existence, because it's important that we be who we are. And that's all we want.
Can you talk a little bit about your own connection to boarding schools?
Well, like, I think when I went to boarding school, it wasn't really exactly like it was back at the turn of the century or before. There was still an emphasis on assimilation and acculturation, like learning trades and learning to become a citizen, an American citizen. So that was still emphasized. But I believe that at the same time, when I was in school, cultural activities were not prohibited. You were allowed to be an Indian when I went to boarding school. And it wasn't really in the boarding school, but it was at the same time. It was a government policy of relocation, they called it. And relocation, a lot of the students I went to Haskell with, after they finished there, they went on relocation, which was they were located in cities to live after they got their education at Haskell. Then their next step was for them to go live in Los Angeles or Minneapolis or Chicago. And then the government kind of, Bureau of Indian Affairs kind of helped them along to make it. And that was still a form of assimilation that carried down into the 50s and 60s. But what I noticed about those individuals that went on relocation, they always came back in the summertime for the religious ceremonies of the tribe and the social ceremonies of the tribe. They always maintained that connection. So that's what I've noticed about our people, you know, their resiliency about being their heritage. And so that's a good thing. Today, we see kind of a resurgence of Native culture throughout the country with our people. Our tribe here has one of the largest powwows in this area. We get Natives from all over the Western states, in Canada, to attend the powwow. So you see these activities like that growing. You know, that's healing too. That's a form of healing. You know, not only us, but everyone needs to heal in this country about the experience with Native people. And first of all, look at what happened. You know, you can cover up things, but the more you cover up, the more people want to know about it.
I've been talking with John St. Clair, who helped bring William Nacoque home. John, thank you so much for talking to me.
You're welcome.
Up next, a woman receives a rare diagnosis that takes her on a journey to finding out the true cost of life-saving technologies. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Jackson Hole Catherine Standifer received her MFA in nonfiction from the University of Arizona. She published her first book in 2020. Lightning Flowers, My Journey to Uncover the Cost of Saving a Life, was a finalist for the Kirkus Prize for Nonfiction and made the New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice. Wyoming Public Radio's Grady Kirkpatrick spoke with Catherine Standifer about Lightning Flowers.
You wrote an incredible memoir about your rare medical diagnosis of a heart condition you discovered while you were living in Jackson. Tell us about Long QT syndrome.
Long QT syndrome is considered to impact 1 in 2,000 people right now, although they suspect that it could be more than that now that genetic testing is becoming more common. A lot of people might be living with it and not know. And essentially, the heart is a muscular organ, and every time it beats, it has to electrically prepare for the next beat. And this interval in the heart is called repolarization. And in medicine, they label that process with letters. So from Q to T in that heart repolarization process is a certain segment of the heartbeat. And that's an area where our hearts can get a little desynchronized. So sometimes parts of the heart are ready to beat and other parts are not ready to beat. And so what you end up with is a heart that is quivering instead of pumping blood. Long QT syndrome has many, many types, but most people have one of the main three. My sister and I have type 2 long QT syndrome, in which the heart can be thrown off because of adrenaline. So often it's a startle response. My sister actually started going into cardiac arrest when her roommate's alarm clock was going off in college.
Your family is originally from Chicago, and when you were 15, you traveled to Wyoming and Jackson Hole. Describe that first morning you woke up in the backcountry and fell in love with the area.
We had driven the day before down so many dirt roads. I didn't really understand where we were going. Now I understand that we were driving from Jackson down into the southern Wyoming range. And I was so turned around. And that night when we finally got to camp after backpacking about 3.5 miles uphill into this little valley, we slept out under the stars. And I remember waking up and hearing the sound of a road. And I kept thinking, like, how could there be a highway nearby? We drove so far away from everything. What am I missing? And I finally realized, oh, that's just the sound of the wind.
Yeah. You moved to Wyoming after college and enjoyed a very active lifestyle, hiking and biking. You worked as a ski instructor and climbing guide. And you were just 24 in the summer of 2009 when you passed out and ended up in the St. John's emergency room. What was your initial reaction upon learning that you also had long QT syndrome?
From the moment I woke up in the parking lot where I had passed out with gravel in my forehead, as soon as I kind of came to and understood who I was and where I was, I knew that my life was about to change forever. I had already seen my sister go through what it was like to have this condition. She had gone into repeated cardiac arrest and ended up with a cardiac defibrillator implanted. And I didn't know whether or not I would end up with the device on that day, but I did know that very likely the ways I'd been earning my living and the freedom I'd enjoyed to live as an uninsured person. And of course, this was in 2009, so it's before the Affordable Care Act existed. I was waking up with what was known then as a pre-existing condition, and I was going to have trouble getting care potentially for the rest of my life. So I was thinking, wow, I can't be a writer. Not just I can't do outdoor education for work, which was devastating, but also I can't live this life where I'm kind of tenuously stringing together jobs in order to further my art. I'm going to have to find insurance some way, somehow, through some job. So it really was like a bomb went off in my whole sense of my future.
Tell us about the first of many difficult decisions you had to make. You had to move from Jackson to Boulder, Colorado, for the procedure to install a defibrillator.
I did. My parents and I had a long conversation to sort through what our options might be. And at the time, there weren't a lot of great options. Wyoming didn't have a high-risk insurance pool. Medicaid did not cover single adults. You had to be a child getting covered or be blind or have some other special designation. And so we determined that my best option was to move to Boulder, where my younger sister's surgeon had said he could help me, but only if I were a local. He was willing to donate his fee. He was willing to help arrange things at the hospital for me. In the end, I quit my life overnight and drove to Boulder and spent time both looking for jobs kind of endlessly. This was the heart of the recession, so it was not an easy time to settle somewhere. And also looking for housing, whatever would make me a resident fastest. And I ended up getting the surgery about two-ish months after I had arrived in Boulder, going in through the ER one night when I had chest pain.
Yeah, you had the defibrillator for a few years. You moved to Tucson. You'd been living without any major incidents. Then one day your heart received multiple shocks, even up to 2,000 volts. Tell us about that day on the soccer field, and maybe you can read an excerpt from that chapter.
Nothing can prepare you for what it feels like to be shocked by an implanted cardioverter defibrillator. Like a badly spliced film reel, my memory of the night is fractured. In one instant, a player on the other intramural soccer team has fallen and the game stopped. He was getting up, brushing his thighs. In the next, my hands became claws. A maul cracked open my chest with a sickening thump, a hot whip tearing through my back. Did somebody kick in my spine? And then I knew, and I was screaming. There's no way you wouldn't scream if you felt it, my sister had said. By then, the defibrillator had been in my body for 3 silent years, resting loyally above my left breast, keeping watch for the arrhythmia that could send me to the ground unconscious, with a heart quivering rather than pumping blood. Now, on a crisp November night in Tucson, Arizona, I dropped to my knees in time for the second shock. What if it doesn't stop? I knew something was wrong, either with my device or with my body, but probably my ICD. If it was an arrhythmia, I should have been collapsed, unconscious, not sharp and alive like this, staring at the backs of houses at the edge of the field, their kitchen light spilling dully out the windows as I screamed. Call 911. A third shock. You can either scream or breathe, a voice inside me said, and I began to pull in air, hold heavy breaths, the way I'd learned to breathe into pain in yoga. I am either alive or dead, and I choose which. The device did not fire again.
Catherine Stanifer reading from her book, Lightning Flowers. What initially inspired you to become a writer?
I have wanted to be a writer since I was 7. I have these memories very early on of almost feeling like my feelings were too big or my experience of the world needed to be pinned down. Makes it sound so surgical, but it was more like a love letter. I really view something like Lightning Flowers as a love letter to the land. And I think from the time I was 7, I got a lot of positive feedback around writing, and it felt like an adventure. It felt like a way to transcend the place that I lived, which I didn't love growing up in the Chicago suburbs, even though my family was able to offer, you know, a largely safe home and all of those good things. I just came alive in landscapes. And so land in particular has always been this important engine in my writing. And I was a poet and a fiction writer until the day I passed out in the parking lot. And I just remember waking up and thinking, oh God, this is going to be a wild story. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I can tell I'm living into something that not many people live, and it can't be an accident that I'm a writer. And so the nonfiction writer in me was really birthed then.
You're now back in Wyoming, living in Kelly with that incredible view of the Tetons. How have you been?
I'm great. I am so happy to be in Kelly. I actually, from my new porch, I can see the entrance to the ranch where I spent time when I was 15, 17, 18, and 19.
Wow.
And so that is absolutely a magic homecoming. It's really amazing to be back. The biggest update in my life right now is I'm actually about to have my next heart surgery on December 2nd. And so I'm walking into the next chapter of everything that Lightning Flowers is about.
Catherine Stanifer, we certainly wish you all the best. And the book is Lightning Flowers, My Journey to Uncover the Cost of Saving a Life. It's available in bookstores and online. Thank you very much. It's been such a pleasure talking with you and an honor.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can hear an extended interview with Catherine Stanifer online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, today's audio and digital producer, and thanks to Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.